Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Dan, our next guest, I'm really looking forward to, because in their quiet moments, any salesperson will tell you that a company's success begins with positive sales. Here to talk about that thought and more in his thought-provoking book, and I love this title, Naked Sales, How Design Thinking Reveals Customer Motives and Drives Revenue, is Justin Jonas, one of the co-authors. Justin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, Justin, tell us a little bit about what your book's about, its title again, and how people can get it, and then I'll turn it over to Dan.
Sure. Yeah. Naked Sales is essentially about how we in sales can hack the way we go about selling, and it really involves stripping away a lot of the habits that we've formed as sales professionals over the years and returning to, you know, that essential human ingredient of the quality of connection we have with our customers. We give some very specific ways to do that. And I think you asked, you know, how can you find the book? It's on Amazon.
Well, everything's on Amazon, it appears, today. But Justin, before I turn you over to Dan, tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. Yeah, I started my career in marketing and sales and then spent a lot of time in management consulting, working with leaders and leadership teams in problem solving strategies for their business. And it was while I was doing that work that I stumbled upon design thinking. And design thinking is a method for creative problem solving or for innovation. And I really became enamored with it because it pushes people to be their creative best. And I also, as I was doing a lot of design work with clients, could remember, you know, what it was like to be out there selling day in and day out. And I had this hunch that the tools that I was using with clients to innovate could actually really help salespeople do a much better job at selling. And that was really the birthplace of Sell by Design and what eventually became Naked Sales.
Dan, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. Justin, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Interesting, you know, we are, as a nation, we are a sales-driven country. I remember I've been in the financial service business for 43 years, and many decades ago, I met the sales manager for the Kemper Insurance Company out of Chicago. And on his desk, I'll never forget this, on his desk was a card, a tent card, and it said, "The sales department is the company." Because nothing happens until somebody sells something.
That's right.
And so, but you know, we look at sales from lots of different perspectives. Some people think it's a very easy business, and other people think it's a very hard business. Having been in sales all of my life, selling myself, my services, and my intellectual property, it's a hard job. But there are a lot of people who say, "I think I want to go to the sales department," but have no ability to communicate to their wives or children or anybody else on staff, much less to customers who have a need for a product. So when you looked at the sales process, were there one or two things that were blatantly obvious to you that a huge percentage of the salespeople make?
Yeah, and first let me just say I share your empathy with sales and your love of sales. It's amazing to be in sales, and really there's no better time to have a career in sales. It's a really exciting time, given all the change that's out there with technology. I think, you know, we see that there's a lot of great content and programs out there in terms of the process of sales, the science of sales. There are amazing tools, technology tools, that salespeople can use to, you know, maintain notes about accounts and help move an account through their sales pipeline. But the big gap that we see is maybe related to what you were just describing, Dan, that people may not know how to really connect. And, you know, for all of our great technology, people still buy from other people. You know, sales is about change making, and change is scary for people. We need a trusted partner to go down the pathway of change. So I think, you know, what we are providing is a how-to for the art side of sales, how you really connect on a deep level with someone so that together you discover a lot of new opportunities that maybe neither of you knew existed that you can solve for together. There's not so much out there about how to do that really well, and design, as it turns out, is very helpful in that regard.
I'm going to interrupt here and ask, because it's an obvious, will you describe what you mean by design thinking?
Yeah, sure. And we try to really demystify that when we work with our clients. So at its essence, it's a creative problem-solving process. And, you know, it's used for innovation. And as a methodology, it works great when you're not really sure where you're going. You know, when there's a lot of complexity or ambiguity, design really helps you out because it teaches you to connect really deeply with the people for whom you are designing, the end user, or if we're thinking in terms of sales, maybe your customer's customer. So once you understand, you know, at a deep level what those people really care about, you can design a solution that really works for them, and you can move faster because you have all of the research that you've conducted and you have greater confidence in the idea that you're bringing forward. So it works similarly in sales. How do you connect with your customer and their customers so that maybe you understand things about their business that they might not fully understand, and you can add value out of the gate, and maybe even find a bigger solution?
Back to you, Dan. I just had to ask the question because I didn't know what he meant by it.
Sure.
Thank you. One of the things that I have, is I've trained people, thousands of brokers through my career, is that I say that successful salespeople, regardless of whatever it is they're selling, are consummate storytellers. And if we understand that people buy products or services for the benefits that they produce, then we build stories about those features, benefits, advantages of the product that we have, we can be more successful. People don't buy a Rolex watch on how it's made. It's a status symbol. People buy Timex watches because they just want to know what time it is. So understanding, as you said, what the needs, wants, and desires of your customer are very important. But I want to ask you another question. I want to go back in just a few moments ago. You've won probably three times that I could recall in this discussion. You have used the word we. So my question to you is, who is we?
Yeah. So our company, Somersault Innovation, is led by myself and actually Ashley Welch, my business partner. And we have a team of consultants in the United States and in Europe. And together, we work with clients on helping their sales teams achieve breakthroughs.
Do you only work with big companies, or do you also work with small companies and everything in between?
You know, we do work with companies of any size. Having said that, though, our clients tend to be larger, established companies. And we think the reason for that is that it goes back to something I said a moment ago, that design works best in complexity. So we've been learning that a lot of our clients who really find the most value are those clients that have really complex offerings. It's a technology solution, for example, that could be customized in a myriad number of ways.
Right.
It may not work best if you're only selling Rolex watches. That's all you have to sell. But the more complex your sales offering and your sales process is, the better design methods can help you achieve success.
So technology companies that deal with highly complex computer software programs or machines or whatever would be because of their nature, their sales processes tend to be more technical in nature than selling over diamonds over the counter. But by the same token, if you don't, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, if you don't know the story, then the customer that you're trying to sell to is going to look at you glassy-eyed and has no idea what you're saying or how it's going to help him. So I guess my next question would be, in these highly technical areas that you work in, how do you get clients?
I think that no matter how complex the offering is, what design helps us remember is that it's still about people, that human beings hire or fire a technology because they want to get something done. And so our task in sales is, I like how you said it, it's about storytelling. It's not only being a good storyteller, but it's also about being a good story finder. So in sales, how good are you at understanding the narratives that drive what people care about? You know, if a customer is thinking about your technology or other solution, why is it that they think they might want that? You know, what is it they imagine they think they're solving for? Or even better yet, how would any solution impact your customer's customer? And what new stories could you tell based on the new relationship that your solution might create? So that's really how we help, how we find clients is those companies that suspect they're not really doing as good a job as they could and should be doing at knowing their customers and really being the right partner for their customer.
So are you saying that you think, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, are you saying that management of these companies may know, for example, that they've got a great product, but the potential buyers first, and this is the most important, the potential buyers don't know that they have a need for your product. Hence, the sales department's responsibility is to expound upon the features, benefits, and advantages of the technology and that the company can benefit from it.
Yeah, I would actually back up even further and say, forget about your great product or service. Who cares? Everybody else has a great product or service. That's table stakes. You better have something that's worthwhile or you won't be in the market. The question is, how well do you understand your customer and what drives them? What we're teaching salespeople to do is to forget their bag of tricks, their products or services, and go into the client system to learn about them and their customers. So that even when you're talking about the solution, you're still not talking about your products or services. You're talking about the problems that they would like to solve in their own language, right? And you may never even mention the name of your product or service. They don't care. They don't need to know. they just need to know they have a partner who can help them get from A to B, and it's a B they care about.
So it's discovering either discovering the need on the part of your sales force to what the customer has, or in addition to that, the customer understanding that they need you, need your product
or
service.
That's right. That's right. And frankly, if in sales, and I'm sure you know this from your experience, if all we have to offer is a known solution, you know, the one that we brought with us to a known problem, that's just not good enough anymore. Because they've already Googled you. They already know how your solution stacks up to all your competitors. They probably have your price point. So you're at the risk of being a commodity. Where you can create value is when you help them see problems they didn't know or hadn't identified. And you can therefore talk about maybe a larger solution. That's value. And that's competitive difference as well.
We used to call that when I first started out in sales and training at Merrill Lynch, it was finding the differential advantage. What makes
that's
you
right.
different than anybody else? And
that's
exploit
right.
that difference.
Yeah.
Dan, let
that's
me jump
exactly
in
right.
here because this is fascinating.
Sure.
But we went a couple of weeks ago, there was something in New York called PepCom, which is where companies get to pitch to newsmakers their various products. And this particular mm-hmm. edition of it featured a lot of home products, which, someone was pitching the fact that you could control your overhead fan by your smartphone. And almost all of the exhibits there. And what struck me more than anything else was the complete lack of communication between the people demonstrating and the visitors, because it didn't seem as if they were selling so much as saying what a great product we had. And listening to Justin and you just now, it seems that that was a great example of it. What do you think, Justin?
Yeah, I think, you know, most of us in sales, it's too easy to be focused on the close. You know, we even when we go into a client, we maybe already have a hunch of which product or service they're going to buy. And so we can fall into a habit of prematurely talking about that particular product or service and maybe trying to hit on the particular benefits we think that customer may most appreciate out of their ceiling fan. And what we're saying is stop talking about the fan. First find out what are their rooms like? And do they have a fan? And if so, why? What do they use it for? What's important to them about that fan? Because demos are all too common in the technology world. We're constantly demoing a platform or a specific tool. But yet if we don't really understand what they might use it for or what they really value, it's just a kind of canned demo. And you're right, we're not really communicating to each other. It's like this auto replay that we're on, which is pretty mind-numbing. I mean, out of empathy for salespeople, it can become pretty mind-numbing if you just go in and it's, you know, pitch after pitch, the same product, the same product, the same product. That's not really much fun for us either. It's a lot more fun to learn about our customers and what's unique about them.
Find the customer's need and then fill it.
Sure.
Because if you don't know what the customer, what their concerns, what their needs, wants, and objectives are, I find it impossible to try and figure out what to sell them. You could have the greatest mm-hmm. catalog in the world of thousands of products, but if you don't understand what the needs are of the customer, and then try and find out what that need is and see if you've got something in your quiver that's going to make that customer better, more productive, you can spend an enormous amount of time smiling and dialing for people just trying to get, and you'll get some people who'll just buy based on the cold call, but the meaningful mm-hmm. relationships don't happen. I think that's another thing I'd be interested in your perspective. I always taught brokers that it takes about 5 presentations to convince a particular customer to come with you and invest with you. And a lot of people are unwilling to invest 5 calls. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if what about a frequency and content in your business, how that's impacted?
Well, I can't give you a magic number in terms of this is the right number of touches or contacts you should expect before you're moving a solution toward close or signature. What I can tell you is that, and this won't be surprising to hear, that the more authentic and engaging you are in your contact, the more value you're bringing to those conversations, the number of touches diminishes significantly. We did do a pilot with an account team at Salesforce, and this particular sales team, they're called hunters, and they were, you know, the quintessential cold caller, prospector. Their job was to bring new business in the door. And through teaching them the methodology of sell by design, they tracked how many calls it took on average to get into a customer account. And we were able to cut the number in half. It took half as much time for them to get to the first significant meeting where they could start engaging the client.
What did they change?
What they changed, you know, you were talking earlier about it's all about finding, you know, the client's need. And yes, that's maybe in some respects the obvious aspect of sales. We have to know what the customer needs in order to offer something to them. But when that gets really interesting is where clients don't actually know all of what they need. And in the complexity of today's environment, that's increasingly the case. They're not even sure which questions to ask. So if you were to spend time in your discovery to go out and experience your customer's customer, you have first-person evidence of what it's like to engage with that account as a customer. And you have a lot more insight about what's great about their business, about their products and services, and where they might have some gaps. So if you can bring that conversation to the table, that's a call that people are willing to take a lot sooner rather than a call about, hey, let me give you a demo of our amazing products and services.
You know, I used to train a lot of brokers in my life and wholesalers and salespeople, and I believed in one thing. A path to success. The person who asks a question and shuts up and listens to what the customer answers gives mm-hmm. you a great deal of insight as to where the customer is at any given point in time. It's more mm-hmm. important to have the customer talk than you to talk.
Yes. And it's even more than that. You're absolutely right. You know, you're doing it right to the extent they're doing all the talking. And what they're talking about matters. So, for example, this goes back to the concept of storytelling that you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've gotten pretty good in sales at asking sort of pain point oriented questions. Like the classic one would be, what keeps you up at night? And you get some interesting information, but the downside of any response that you get to that kind of question is that mm-hmm. people are telling you their own conclusions or their own assumption about what the issue is. Mm-hmm. And they're not always right. They don't always understand it. And our job in sales is to kind of push through that, to understand as closely as we can what things are actually like so that we can draw our own conclusions. And the best way to do that is to invite your customer to tell you very specific stories. Mm-hmm. You know, storytelling is a way for them to bring you into their world. So,
right.
Yes, you want to get the customer talking, but can you get them talking about their best customer and why they are their best customer? Or can you get them talking about a recent mistake that they made or problem that they had? If you can get them talking about a very specific story or situation, you will learn so much more than you ever could from an answer to what keeps you up at night.
Right. Right. So let me go one step further and move to the process.
Sure.
Is your company philosophy as it relates to salespeople, do you believe in hiring experienced salespeople or hiring young people who have passion and want to succeed and train them in your method?
Yeah. Well, there's advantages to both. So we wouldn't say you should go one way over the other. I think the amazing thing that we've seen with more tenured sales professionals when we work with them is they experience a kind of remembering of what it was like earlier in their career, because we're helping them shed a lot of habituation that they picked up along the way. So it's, their experience is kind of a mix of blessing and bane. Their experience really helps them. You know, they're maybe further down the field about engaging with customers and establishing rapport. But where their experience can hurt them is, you know, when you're really good at what you do, it's harder for you to see things with fresh eyes. And so you may become more victim to missing something really important, because you're already predicting what kind of a sale or transaction this client is going to end up being, and you have blinders on. Once you do that, and it only takes like a nanosecond, it's harder for you to see more opportunity that's there. It's hard to stay fresh and frosty. The benefit to being new is that you have a beginner's mind. And, you know, when you're working on a complex deal, that can really help you to notice as many interesting things as you can in your discovery and bring it into the solution conversation. So there's pluses and minuses to both. And we enjoy working with people well established in their careers and, you know, in their first year in their career.
Dan, I hate to break in here. It's been fascinating. We're talking with Justin Jones, who's got a fascinating new book. Dan, one more question.
So what do you think right now, as you're looking at training people today, what is the biggest shortcoming in the sales forces that you're seeing today that you're trying to reorient?
They are not curious. And what I mean by that is they are not genuinely curious about their customers and what they're trying to solve for. And that sets them up at an enormous disadvantage. And there's a lot of great reasons why they're not very curious. We help them tap back into that spontaneous sense of curiosity and, frankly, wonder, because it's amazing the companies that are out there and what they're doing with their customers. I mean, it's fascinating when you're really genuinely curious. That's probably one of the biggest gaps we see.
Right. I agree. Thank you for your time. It was a great interview. Don?
Yeah. Thank you both.
Don?
Justin, the name of your book again?
Naked Sales: How Design Thinking Reveals Customer Motivation and Drives Revenue.
It's been fascinating. I learned a lot, and I hope our audience did as well. There'll be a link to your book. And what's your website besides Amazon?
Sure. SomersaultInnovation.com. SomersaultInnovation.com.
Cool. Question: how did you come up with that name?
That's a great question. We were trying to capture what it feels like when you start working with design principles and tools. And there's kind of a childlike, playful, can-do energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were trying to think of what is it that kids do that we can all do that's a fun thing to do. And that's where Somersault came from.
Okay. Well, we always ask them because some of the most innovative things come from titles. Justin Jones, thank you so much for being with us. Dan, any final thoughts?
No, thank you for your time and insight, and it was a pleasure to talk to a professional about something I've been doing for 50 years.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. Thank you both. You guys take care.
You are.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Welcome back to Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business. Now it's time to bring together our two experts, Dan Perkins and Don Mazzella, as they discuss things that are happening now that are affecting your business success.
Saba is a management tool for tracking and measuring employees, reinforcing business goals, and providing employees the freedom to help shape their own career paths. Here to tell us about it and the greatest expense companies don't know is Anita Bonus, Saba's Global Practice Leader for Strategic Services. Anita, welcome to the program. You came to us because you had a fascinating line about companies don't really know what's the most expensive item in their budget. Can you talk about that, about a little bit about Saba and a little bit of your background as well?
Sure. So I think the line that you're referencing is, you know, we often think about the greatest cost to doing business or when we're setting up and starting a business or, you know, trying to grow an entrepreneurial business, we sometimes forget that the biggest cost on our budget is really the cost of our people and, you know, what it takes to make sure that we have the right people, resources, or talent working with us to bring our vision to life and to help us grow and shape our businesses. And, you know, this is something that for small businesses as well as businesses in mid-market and larger organizations, you know, making this connection between our employees and the culture that we're trying to build and, you know, connecting it to what we're trying to achieve strategically is one of the top concerns for CEOs today. What we do here at Saba is, sure, we're a software company, but we're more than that. We create a foundation or a platform for organizations to grow and develop their talent, to drive their performance, to make sure that they have the skills, the experiences to be successful in the work that they do today. And I think we're going to talk about this in a little bit more detail today, so that we can help our employees get the most out of their work and then in turn bring their best every day to their jobs. And many people call this driving employee engagement. A little bit about me. I've been working in HR for, well, more than two decades now, and I have worked for organizations of many sizes, including a lot of small startup consulting firms that have worked with small and mid-sized businesses, entrepreneurial organizations. And as I was mentioning before we kicked this off, I'm also married to an entrepreneur, and so these are topics that are near and dear to my heart.
Well, go a little further now. How does Saba help shape the career, and how do employees and employers utilize it to make a win-win situation?
Sure. So Saba is a platform that, you know, at our roots is about developing our employees. So Saba's historical roots, you know, as a software platform has very much been within the learning space. So think about a learning management system, but it's more than that now. And over time, we know, we understand that learning takes place in many different ways. I think sometimes we use learning and training as synonyms. So, you know, I want to learn something, I want to get better at my job, I need to take a course, or I need to, you know, attend a workshop. But we learn as adults in particular in a lot of different ways. Maybe we're going to do a Google search and we're going to find an article or a reference that we're going to directly use in the work that we're doing. Maybe we're going to learn with our colleagues, whether we're working with them alongside of them to pick up new skills or having a conversation with them. And many times we learn by being just thrown into the fire and being exposed to new situations. So Saba as a platform from a learning or a learning ecosystem provides us as organizations and our people a way to capture and to track the different learning experiences that we have, whether it's stuff that we have to do, and when I say stuff, training or learning that we have to do, maybe it's for a compliance perspective or it's something that we need to have in order to be certified in something, or maybe it's a skill that we are, you know, quickly ramping up on that we have to learn through trial and error, and we want to capture those activities. We can create that learning ecosystem. But we also know that the number one outcome of learning, the whole reason why we invest in learning as businesses, is we want to drive performance. We want people to be able to do something better or new or innovatively. And so that whole performance equation and driving the performance of individuals and organizations is also something that we can manage through Saba as a platform and consult with organizations around. So making sure that we have clear performance expectations or goals, making sure that we have an opportunity to have regular check-ins or conversations around how we're doing against tracking towards our goals and developing skills needed to be successful in meeting those performance expectations. It really is a tool that allows for dialogue and collaboration between managers and employees, and really to the end of making sure that we're developing our people and we're driving our organizational performance. That, in a long-winded nutshell, is what we do here at Saba.
Now, Dan, it's all yours. She's given us an awful lot of questions, and I know you do such a great job.
All right. Thank you. Welcome, Anita. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Just a quick observation about your opening remark about the cost of personnel.
Yes.
Would I be wrong to say that regardless of the size of the business, personnel cost is one of the most cost-intensive parts of the business?
You would not be wrong. If you think about, you know, a lot of our industries today, whether we're talking, you know, manufacturing or knowledge-based economies, we need people to execute on our business strategy, to execute on our vision, to do things at all levels of the organization. So that is a significant investment, a significant cost to the business, and, you know, making sure that those people are aligned and have the skills to be able to perform their jobs is an investment that organizations of all sizes are focused on. So
right.
That's absolutely accurate.
So Let me ask you, I have a couple of questions. One's going to be kind of futuristic, but I'll get to that in a little bit. I'm was fascinated listening to your answer to Don's questions. Is what you do, would it be fair to say, is a collaborative effort between you as consultants and the management, senior management team, in developing a strategy, but also assisting them in making and setting goals for the business and for the employees, and then measuring to that success goal?
I think that's a really accurate perception. Some organizations come to us here at Saba, and they have that strategy defined. They have that worked out. Perhaps, you know, there are large organizations that have an organizational development team, or a number of different resources in the human resources function whose area of expertise is similar to, you know, that of mine and my team. But when we work with smaller organizations, you might have a single senior leader that's responsible for all things personnel or human resources related. And they know what they want to accomplish, but they need some help and assistance in figuring out how to get there. And that's absolutely the kind of work that we do here within my team at Saba. We work with organizations that have that strategy already defined and mapped out, and we work with them to make it a reality. And then we'll also work with organizations that have a vision of what they want to achieve, and we will help them plan that strategy. We also work with organizations, too, that come to us, you know, with the question around, you know, how does engagement and employee engagement factor in to all of this, and making sense out of that and bringing it into something that's practical that they can action. And that's also work that we do here within my team.
Do you only operate domestically, or do you operate globally?
Globally. We are a global organization. I'm smiling because I was up at 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time today on a global call having a conversation about this very topic with an organization that's got folks in Asia, Europe, and North America. So we are a global organization, and I have the bags under my eyes to prove it. But we have we have folks on the ground in offices around the globe.
So let me throw a couple of background facts for you, and then I'll get to the specific question. Over this past weekend, there was a report that the average birth rate for American women is 1.7 children, not enough to replace the parents. The other parts of the world are even worse off. Europe has a tremendous disparity. China is in chaos because they had a one-child policy, and now they've got 30,000 single males, and that's going to create a huge problem. The problem that all of this lack of population is leading to right now, and it's one of the reasons why Germany allowed so many foreign nationals to come in, is that there's a shortage of labor. Now, we have in the United States, most recently, our unemployment rate is near or close to significant lows. And so as somebody developing programs with from a personnel standpoint, looking a little longer term, it appears that the economies are going to run out of people. There was an article this morning at Amazon where the warehouses, the people working in warehouses are so exhausted, they're starting to install more and more robots to do the human jobs. So what I'm trying to get to is we're looking at a shortage of labor on a global basis. Isn't that going to add tremendous pressure in corporations to try and find the right people?
I think that it will add pressure on corporations to have the right mix of skills and experience in their labor force. And I think when you combine that with the pace of change in technology, using an example, a great example with Amazon and use of robots for artificial intelligence. It's going to change the shape of how we work. I think you will find that, you know, as we move forward, that our traditional labor pool is going to look a little different, where people remain in the workforce longer, perhaps a growth or an expansion in what we call the gig economy, where people move from job to job and it's no longer a career for life. And I think organizations need to be flexible and forward-looking as they build their talent strategies or their personnel strategies to account for this. So you take this, you know, declining birth rate, you take the bubble. I'm speaking to you from Canada today, and we have, you know, a huge bubble of baby boomers that are set to exit the labor force through retirement as well. And, you know, the fact that organizations need to make sure that they're constantly looking at what skills they need their people to have to be successful in the future. It puts a lot of pressure on business leaders and HR professionals around how they do the recruitment, how they do their employee development, to make sure that they retain those great people that they spend a lot of time and effort attracting into their organization. So they want to hold on to the people versus allowing them to leave. It's one of the reasons why, if you read research and statistics by folks like Burson and Deloitte, one of the top concerns of senior leaders is retention and engagement, because you want to keep the people happy, to keep them there, and to keep them from leaving.
Well, following that, you know, if we have, I can't imagine what it's, I've been to Europe many, many times, and the last time I was there was in Germany, and I talked to people, and it was 2 years ago, and there are jobs going empty because the immigrants that are coming in have no skill, and companies are panicking. But I guess the issue becomes, as we realize we need to hire people as a business, and as you said, put together training programs to improve their skills. Are we actually training for somebody else's company? Because this particular skill is in demand, and you get the person gets the training, gets the initials after his or her name, and then gets recruited away by some other company.
Well, if we look at training as more than just those formal credentials or the initials after their names, you know, perhaps. But I would say that you either don't train your people, and then you have a workforce that may not be fully qualified or fully capable to be successful at what you need them to do, or you make a focused effort to invest in your people in terms of development, but also in terms of their workplace experience. And development is one of those big predictors or contributing factors to employee engagement. Investing in your people will actually increase the likelihood that you will retain them. So I think it's a short-sighted, myopic view to not invest in your people for fear that they're going to leave. Chances are, if you don't invest in them, they're going to leave for opportunities elsewhere. So if we look at, you know, I'm a Gen Xer. I have on my team quite a few millennials. And, you know, growing our skill set, growing and developing our careers is something that's very important to us, as it is, I think, if you talk to folks across all the different generations that comprise our workforce today globally. And, you know, getting better and better at something is something that folks find very motivational. And for organizations that do not invest in developing their people, that can become a very demotivating place to be. So it is a really strong way that you can retain that top talent in your organization when you invest in them and help grow their abilities to shape their careers with you and stay.
Are you basically creating the scenario that basically says, when we started this conversation, we talked about your comments with Don about labor costs. If we're going to have to invest more and more and more in our employees, aren't our labor costs going to continue to escalate as a percentage of operating expenses?
I would say they won't. And if we go back to, we think about how people learn, adults learn on the job largely through social learning and collaboration with their peers, coaching conversations with managers or subject matter experts on the floor through being exposed to new scenarios or special projects. And those don't have to cost a thing. There's no tuition. There's no, training fee per se to that. And then when we look at the cost of replacing people because they've chosen to leave to pursue opportunities elsewhere, a statistic might be to replace an employee might be as much as 1.5 times their annual salary. Having a retention issue where you're constantly looking external to replace and backfill your positions, that is like a broken window or a leak in the foundation of your business that escalates and increases your labor costs. So shoring up and creating a positive employee experience, a culture that focuses on developing your people for the roles they're in today and where you need them to grow to be successful in the future is actually a really smart investment to make and will pay dividends down the road.
Let me ask Don real quick. Do I have time for another question?
Oh, of course. You're doing such a good job. I'm keeping quiet and listening. I'm learning.
I want to use a real-life example of my number four son who spoke with us the day before Thanksgiving. His company just announced that his health insurance premiums will now triple and his deductibles will go for one person $14,000 a year. And so the question becomes, well, we've been talking about labor cost, another part of the equation that has accelerated dramatically over the last few years is the cost of medical benefits. And my son is saying, I basically took a pay cut because the premium that I'm paying for my health insurance tripled. I've got to look for a different job. Wow. So now we have a factor that isn't payroll cost, it is benefits cost, and the company in this case. We have seen over the last 8 years, at least in the States, with the advent of Obamacare, health insurance premiums have gone through the roof, and deductibles. I mean, there's no way he can do $14,000 worth of out of pocket, so he's paying triple for the cost of insurance. Will probably never get through the deductibles, so he's getting nothing except a significant reduction in his paycheck. And so that's an issue that's not labor cost directly in terms of hourly benefits, but it is something that corporations are going to have to deal with if healthcare costs continue to rise.
And I think, that is something that goes, I think, beyond the scope of a conversation around employee development and employee skills, but it is a genuine concern, particularly in the North American and the American marketplace. So, I will admit I'm Canadian, and so we may not have the same pressures when it comes to healthcare costs and expenses. But, the benefit package, so the total rewards package, goes well beyond just salary and development costs, obviously. And that is a huge burden, particularly for small businesses. One contributor, and this is not in any way going to mitigate that total impact of factors, outside perhaps the control of a small business owner or a mid-sized business owner, but when you create a culture where people are feeling engaged, they're happy to come to work, they know that the organization is invested in them, there's actual research that demonstrates that organizations with higher employee engagement outperform those that do not invest in programs and have lower engagement scores in just about every type of performance metric, including healthcare costs. There's been research done by Gallup. That's one of the world's leading research organizations, and they have a very strong practice in employee engagement where they look at the impact that highly engaged workforces have on businesses and business outcomes, and one of the trackable measures that they have been able to demonstrate is an impact on healthcare costs too, as well as, you know, quality issues, as well as safety. So we're not just talking about, and I'm using air quotes here, touchy-feely, you know, make everybody feel happy and happiness at work. We're talking about hard metrics that impact top and bottom line for businesses that come from investing in your people and creating a workplace culture where people thrive. So, you know, while that may not mitigate the total impact of, you know, rising healthcare costs, you know, it can have some mitigating effect, I think.
So let me ask you a compensation question. Since you're a global company, and I know that it's probably going to be a difficult question for you to answer because everything is not equal, but do you have a sense of where, if there is such a thing, the average American worker, where they fit in on a global basis in salary and benefits? How well or poor do we pay our people relative to the rest of the world?
You know, I'm not a compensation expert when it comes to global compensation. So, you know, my experience is solely within the organization that I work in. As a global organization, we make sure that we benchmark across industries. You know, I will say that obviously from a social programs perspective and insurance that's provided, you know, outside of, you know, the cost to the employer, Western European countries and, you know, dare I say Canada, because of elements that are provided, you know, by our state, we don't have the same impact of healthcare costs and benefits. I think by and large, when it comes to professional workers, American organizations are, you know, on par with their global competitors and global organizations. And we are increasingly in a global workforce where talent mobility is not just within our own borders. So I think organizations are being very careful to make sure that, you know, they're at least on trend when it comes to wage and compensation surveys locally so that they're able to attract and retain the best talent. But particularly for those that compete on a global scale, they're paying attention and benchmarking across geographies as well.
My last question.
You know, I hate to break in here, Anita, but our time is nearly up. We're talking with Anita Bonus. She's Saba's Global Practice Leader for Strategic Services. Anita, tell us your website again and how people can reach you.
So you can reach me through our global website. It's www.saba.com. And if you reach out through our contact us, I'm sure, and you're interested in learning more, they will route you through to me. My email address is abowness, so ABOWNESS at saba.com.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure. And a link to your website will be on www.recalculating.biz tonight. Thank you for being with us, Anita.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Dan, tell us a little bit about your new book.
The book literally just went on for sale on Amazon. It's called Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? I believe it's the first book of its kind written for children of ages 9 to 12 dealing with dementia. And it's done as a mystery. And it's about two little girls, Hudson and Charlotte, who come face to face with trying to figure out what's happening to James's grandmother who has dementia. The children or grandchildren are the forgotten part of this puzzle of dementia. Mom and dad are spending so much time trying to figure out how to help grandma and grandpa. They pay less attention to the needs of their grandchildren to understand what's happening to grandma and grandpa. So hopefully this book will not only help 9 to 12-year-olders, but also it's also written for an entire family and has a whole series of programs and things that families can do together to preserve the memory of their grandparents. Available at Amazon.com.
And tell them the name of the book again.
Why Can't Grammy Remember Me?
Welcome back to Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business. Now it's time to bring together our two experts, Dan Perkins and Don Mazzella, as they discuss things that are happening now that are affecting your business success. Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.